thanks for tuning in, folks. And you're back with Two Pints in the Corner with Dinky Dawson, Tim Miller, and myself, Tony Rain. And we're here discussing our joint histories at the Channel Club in Boston, known as Boston's Best Live Rock, all through the 1980s. And we hope you enjoy the show.
Morning, this is Sean.
Sean, Tony, how you doing?
Tony, how are you, sir? It's been a while.
I'm good.
Good to hear, buddy.
That's been a while. I was telling Tim about you a little earlier, so he might have some questions. But
okay.
Basically, what I got onto was, you know, I remember you coming in the channel.
Yep.
And what interested me, and I was running this by Dinky, was the way the channel kind of formulated a lot of you guys to split off your own businesses, like Cottage Industry, set up on the back of that, which is obviously that indie movement and all those little different fragments of the genre, you know, the metal and all that stuff, all turned into their own little circles. And it's all fed into the internet.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. I mean, if you look at it, it really kind of respawned the business to a degree.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair, Tony. I think it's it's been an interesting ride, right? I mean, when I started the channel, and it's funny, I was telling Dick, I was trying to figure out the exact date I started there, because I remember for sure I had never been there. I came to Boston in the fall '84. I don't want to get too much off track. If I'm getting off track, let me know. But I came to Boston in September '84 to go to the Northeastern. And I didn't really get into the music thing for a little while. It kind of came into backwards. My first day in school, there was a kid in my dorm who had all dressed like a security guard outfit. And I just said, where do you work? What do you do? And he worked at the Boston Garden, the old Boston Garden, where the Bruins just played, of course. So I said, wow, that's pretty cool. So you get to see the games for free. And I said, yeah. So I ended up getting a job. I went down to apply. I got a job. You know, I think I was making like $3.35 an hour or something, but I didn't care. It was just, you know, I get to see the games for free. And, you know, back in that time, mid-80s, I mean, the Celtics were huge, you know, with Bird and McHale and Parrish and all that, winning championships and the Bruins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I got to see a few shows there, obviously. But one night what happened was, probably like within a year or so, one of my security supervisors just, you know, happenstance said, hey, I got a buddy playing a show tonight in town. You want to go? And I was like, yeah, whatever. I had nothing else going on. So I went with them. And it ended up being Southside Johnny at the channel. And you know, I'd never been there before, and I was just like, I walked in there, and you know, he had backstage passes and stuff. He knew someone with the band, I think, and the Asbury Juke. So we got there, I went in, and my eyes just like exploded. I was like, oh my God, you know, what is this? It was like jam packed. I mean, the music was amazing.
Right.
Girls everywhere, just partying. And I'm like, this is incredible. So literally the next day, I went back to the channel and got a job as a bouncer, making $5 an hour.
I got into the channel thing.
And then the channel kind of led to me getting more in the business end of things, right? So, I mean, I started just bouncing, and then, you know, eventually head of security, and then eventually I started doing a few shows here and there, and then I got to become assistant general manager, and I started booking bigger shows on the weekends, like most of those all ages hardcore things for the most part. And I was, you know, at the same time I had started doing smaller shows around town, like at Green Street Station and Bun Rowdy's, The Rat, just to kind of start getting into that idea of booking shows. And yeah, but the channel certainly shaped, I mean, you know, if I hadn't found the channel with my security firm, I probably would have never gone into the path I went into, which ended up being, you know, managing bands, clubs, booking shows, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Kind of, like I said, kind of getting off into your own little niche of whatever the business was. I mean, the music business was a lot different back then. There was no music business classes. There was nothing like... I mean, you guys know this. It was just different. There's no phones back then. There's no cell phone. You had to call bands from pay phones and give them directions.
We were talking about that last week, about the guys coming through that used to advance their shows on our phone, you know?
Sure. I mean, you used to make, with the whole DIY thing, right? The do-it-yourself ethos, which is really big on the underground, hardcore, metal scene, punk rock stuff. You really had to find other kids, like-minded kids in different cities that were doing these shows, because a lot of the places were like off the beaten path venues. They're like church halls or, you know, POV studios or basement shows, until bands became big enough that they could play an actual proper room. But, you know, at that point, you know, it took a while to get to that point, obviously. But I mean, even before I got to the channel, I don't want to, you know, I didn't start this at all. Like, Warren was doing shows for years there, like some really big national acts that came through, and all the punk bands from England was landing in Boston typically first, or New York.
Yeah, we'd all been doing it for long enough. But what was of interest to me was, like, I'm trying to remember when you came in.
April 26th.
That was the Southside Johnny show.
Yes, Southside Johnny. What was that?
85.
I was looking this up last night. I went back to that was the first date I looked at, because there was like five different, he used to play like twice a year, right? So I went through the dates and I was trying to match up. It's funny, like last night, trying to figure out, okay, what the hell show did I see at the Garden the night before, the night that I came? Because I started at the Garden that night working security for something. And then we went from there to the channel and I was trying to figure out which one it was. I think it was either that one or even November 22nd, 85. I think it was definitely 85, though.
It was a later one. I remember those. And I was behind the bar at the time. I think it was Mike Smith working security.
Yeah, Mike was there, yep.
So Mike and I got hired on the same night.
Really? Okay. I remember you being there. I remember Mike being there, but I don't remember you starting like when I was there. Maybe you were there before me. I just don't remember offhand.
I was behind the bar.
Okay.
I was running the bar until the end of 85.
Okay.
And then they asked me, because I was working in a restaurant management training thing as well, and they asked me to come in, and Donnie left and asked me to run the operations.
Okay.
So I was doing all the liquor ordering and bartender scheduling
and
all that stuff for the next year.
Say again, Diggy?
April 27th, the next night, Neighborhoods.
Yeah, and I definitely saw the Hoods tons of stuff. That's why I was trying to go back and look through like some of the bands that rung a bell. Because the thing was, I was still work at the Garden, so I didn't like work every single night at the channel for a while. But I did eventually, and that's what I was trying to find out. It became like a daily thing. I just don't remember how far in it was when I started. Because all the bands I looked at, I was looking through the calendar last night on the website, and you know, of course, back then. I mean, you see the Stompers, the Fools, Jumbo Jaraxxus, the Neighborhoods. Those guys are playing, you know, face to face. They were playing like every few months, if not twice a month sometimes. So
my
you saw them so many times. So I'm trying to get my brain figure, okay, what exactly was my actual start date? So, yeah, I think it was either the April 26th Southside show or the November 22nd in 85.
I remember my memory of you, I think, is in 86 when I started getting more involved in the operation. We'd been doing some ska shows, and I had an English guy down there with me. And Morris from Over the Plough and Stars was working for us.
Sure, Morris Behan, yep.
Yeah, and we started doing a ska night on Tuesdays. And I remember you having some involvement with the Boston's, is that right?
Yeah, I was friends with those.
You were friends with them, and you were pulling. I remember you were doing security, and you talked to me about them several times, and I always had that in my head.
You're right.
To do the Boston's, and then next I heard you were. I left at the start of '87 and went and opened Edible Rex.
Okay, sure.
And then you started doing shows out, like you said, and cleaning the stuff out. What was the first act you took out of there? Was it Sam Black Church?
So I had not seen them yet. So what happened was I was working security most of the time at the channel and just kind of running the floor, walking around and checking out. And of course, you know, you could see five, six bands a night back then when they were, you know, we were open every night. So, but the first show, I'm trying to think that was the first one I saw at the channel I actually started working with. But what I had started doing was I was still in touch with, like, I was doing some shows around town, friendly with different club owners. I was close with Chuck White. I'm sure you remember Chuck White and Doug Mellon.
Yeah,
they used to do shows at Green Street Station and Bunratty's later on.
And Martin Doyle.
Martin a little bit too. Yeah.
Well, they came in back then. They came back in 90.
Yeah, a little bit later on. Because I started doing shows. I think I started booking my own shows like under Cringe. I think it was like 88, but not the channel yet. I was doing like, I did like Chuck gave me like Monday nights at Green Street. That's how I do like Monday nights at Green Street. I started doing an 18 plus series. So I was bringing some of the bands that I had seen at the channel, like local bands, like on Metal Tuesday nights or stuff like that, or New Music nights.
Yeah,
I kind of just had heard from being around the Boston scene and going to shows at the Rat and Bun Ratties and whatnot. So I was doing like a, you know, three bands or four bands on a Monday night 18 plus show at Green Street for like $3 or $4 and with the dollar off tickets, and no one's making any money. It was just kind of a thing to get into. So, but then, you know, my first big show at the Channel that I actually booked was the Slapshot, Boss Tones, Maelstrom, and Sandblad Church, actually. That was a big show. It was like a Tang record release show. And that was in September of 1990, I think. 89 or 90. It was 90.
Yeah, that was 90. Yeah, it was right before I came back in. Was Alec Peters still at Tang?
So Curtis was running. Curtis ran Tang Records. He was in Cambridge. He had a studio. He had a little record shop in the in Harvard Square, Cambridge. Curtis Costello. But I had booked a show with him essentially because he had all three bands had a new record coming out. So I'm like, well, and you know, Slapshot had been playing the Channel for a while at that point, and they were friends of mine. I actually ended up living with them for a while. We all had an apartment together. So we were all friends. I was kind of helping them a little bit here and there, and then. With this record coming out for all three bands, and I had already started working with Sandblad Church a little bit, I had booked them at Green Street Station and just completely fell in love with them. I was like, holy crap. So I got them on the bill as the opening acts just because I helped them out, because I was trying to help them get their name out there, obviously. And that show ended up being like 800 kids showed up, and it was unbelievable. It was just like the biggest show I think any of them had played at that point.
Yeah, you get one good winner like that. And
September
1989, September 30.
September 30, 1989, and it was amazing because you had, I've just lost it. Oh, it was the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. First of all, it was Slapshot, then the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, Maelstrom, Sam Black Church. All ages.
Correct.
All ages, 3 p.m. show.
Yeah.
You were good on that all ages stuff. I'm going to slow you down. Slow you down a bit because I want Tim to get you some questions. But again, the one thing that interests me is that you guys were, and Tim, is that you guys were basically running this sub-industry, you know, that grew out of those clubs like the Channel and the Lansdowne Street rooms.
Even like Slapshot was a pretty established band at that point. They were kind of my entry point, so to speak, into the whole hardcore scene. Because, like, you know...
But they were established locally, right?
They were kind of like the next band. Like I said, I got into Boston late 84, but I didn't really get into the music thing until at least a year later. So I had already missed, like, the whole hardcore, like the SSD Control.
Right.
DYS had pretty much stopped. You know, Jerry's Kids had pretty much stopped.
Yeah, they'd all
there were different incarnations after the fact. They still play here and there, but... Like, and Gangrene had really blown up. I mean, Dickie remembers that. They became huge. And they were, like, doing, you know, they could do two shows in a day there sometimes.
That's kind of where I'm trying to get to, is where did it go from just being that little local scene to growing into a good local business to then that going, like, semi-national? And you guys were...
Gangrene was already out there. They were on the road, 85, 86. I think their record was on Roadrunner. And they were hitting the world and really kind of... They had some MTV play back then with the whole Basement Tapes or the 120-minute show they used to do, the hardcore... what the hell was it called? Ricky Rackman had a show on MTV. 120 minutes? No, that was a different one. 120 minutes or Headbangers Ball. Headbangers Ball used to have one, right? So,
Right.
So a lot of those bands that you never got a chance to see or hear before, all of a sudden you could see them at, you know, like midnight on watching MTV. And so bands like Gangrene did get some exposure there. And a few other Boston bands, but not to that kind of level. But I was really kind of trending in that direction. Like I said, I had seen all the classic Boston bands, right? The Stompers, the Fools, Neighborhoods, Turbines. There's so many bands back then, right? I mean, I missed the Atlantics, unfortunately, but there were a lot of bands that were playing there on a pretty regular basis. But I really started to kind of get into the idea of this underage, you know, kids could not get into shows. A lot of shows are 21 plus, right? And when I started the Channel, I was 18, I think, so I couldn't get into some of the shows legally either. So it's kind of like, hey, I want to see some of these bands. And so the bands were also in that same mindset. It's like, hey, we just want to play all ages shows. The kids need to see us. I don't want to play a bar, a 21 plus bar. And so that kind of became a motivation to find other places that would give you either an 18-plus night or maybe do it in a hall. So you rent out a VFW hall.
The VFW circuit and all that started up, right? So
sure.
That's power to you. But again, I keep going back to it. What interests me is that it kind of turned into its own business. And
sure.
To a degree, it kind of exaggerated or inflated just how active Boston was. In the 80s,
yeah.
It looked like there was tons of stuff going on everywhere all the time. But not a lot.
Very true.
No, nobody was really making
money. Yeah, no, very
true,
Tony. And
it's kind of making any money.
It turned out, originally kind of started out with all these bands, like SSD Control in Boston, from my other Nashville, like Minor Threat in D.C., which was a huge one. They were really spoke to the whole underage, all ages, and even to a degree like the whole straight edge thing where no drinking, no drugs, none of that nonsense. And those bands did not want to play clubs. They did not want to play where alcohol was served, or they didn't want to play where it was only 21 plus, so their fans couldn't get in. And it kind of started this kind of weird underground industry. And then it kind of came full circle. Like eventually these bands became so popular you had to find regular venues like the Channel or like the Paradise, like big rooms that could really accommodate the number of kids who were coming out for the show. So
right.
It kind of like went in a weird circle and ended up being where almost, I don't want to say it was mainstream, but you know, I can tell you like when this is a little bit before my time there, but like my friend Nancy Baril, who was married to Al Baril, who's in SSD Control, like she brought Minor Threat to Boston for the first time and it was at the Channel. And she booked it with Warren, and that was 85, I think, or four. And that was like, you know, they had been friends. They had played a couple of like underground shows, and they were getting really popular. And Nancy kind of became their quote unquote like Boston manager to help them get a show in Boston, a proper show. And she, you know, I think I saw that she has a contract. She posted it online every once in a while. I think they got paid like $500 or $1,000 plus bonus after so many, whatever. And it was a huge success. And then later on, when Minor Threat broke up, Ian formed a band called Fugazi.
Yeah.
And Fugazi was another one of those bands. They were very adamant about we're only playing tickets for $5 shows. Only $5 at our shows, no more, no less.
Right.
They have to be all ages. So I kind of got in with them and booked them several times, including, you know, to me, the biggest show I ever booked at the Channel, maybe the biggest show ever happened there was on St. Patrick's Day, ironically, this weekend, right? St. Patrick's Day, 1991, Fugazi at the Channel with my friends, Eye for an Eye, local Boston hardcore band,
yep.
And a band from D.C. called Seven League Bootleg opened up there. Like Bobby from Soulside in D.C. was on, that was his new band. So yep. That show was, I mean, here's the thing. I think we did like literally like 2,500 people. And the reason that happened is because we back then we sold through Strawberries in advance, right? So we were selling advance tickets. And I know we had sold a lot, right? But what we didn't do was we forgot to tell Strawberries to stop selling tickets on Saturday.
Uh-huh.
So it didn't even cross my mind. And we sold like, I think, over 500 tickets either Saturday and Sunday morning, but like people coming in to see the show, they want to make sure they bought a ticket first. So we were overwhelmed. Like we could not believe how many people were there. But we thought we had sold about 1,700 tickets or so, but we never shut it off. And we didn't even think of it. Like, so people kept buying Strawberries tickets all day Saturday and Sunday before the show. And we ended up like over 2,500 people came in that night. It was insane. It was just like biggest crowd by far. Way over the fire limits, of course. But we didn't know. We were an honest mistake. So I remember like paying the band after the show in the dressing room. And they were like, this is the most money I've ever made in our entire career. And it was quite a moment. You know, they were like, they were stunned.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this is not really Channel related, but I brought them back because they really were the biggest band in that era. So I brought them back. We did a show at the Wallace Civic Center out in Fitchburg, which is a hockey rink, maybe the next year. And I had Sam Black Church on that show with them. And that was like, you know, we had 3,500 people showed up, I think. It was massive. And again, at that point, that was also the most money they'd ever been paid at that point. So, you know, I keep getting off track with it, but they're all kind of tied into the Channel in a way. You know, that's really where I kind of cut my teeth in this whole business, this whole underground.
Yeah. I think it got going there, and then as you were doing those bigger crowds, it kept splintering, right? So the goths came out of it.
It was a goth.
And the emo.
I wasn't really big in the goth scene. That was like the Mandrake club scene for most of the part. But there was definitely, we certainly had some goth bands. You know, when you're a big enough band, you know, think about like, I don't know, Jesus, Mary Chain, Lover.
Jesus, Mary Chain.
House, all those bands. Yeah. Used to come to Channel because that was the big, they were all, they merited that kind of a turnout, right? They were all pretty established bands overseas or had the big ones.
What I liked about, and Dinky and I talked about, and you probably got a perspective on it, was when you were in there every day, which we were, you see a different crowd every night.
Absolutely.
It wasn't a club that was in one vein. It's whatever it was that night or that afternoon. So if you were 18 Correct. Years old and coming on a Sunday afternoon for an all-ages hardcore show, that's what it looked like to you.
Correct.
But when we were in there after you'd gone home at 5 o'clock from that show, and we were bringing in a roots reggae, a burning spear or something like that at night.
Absolutely.
It was a completely different club.
Here you go.
Absolutely. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
December 15th, 1991. All right. Bad Brains, Slapshot, Sam Black Church. All ages,
yeah.
Noon show.
Yep.
I remember the load-in.
Early load-in, yeah, exactly.
I remember that
those
day,
those are early, long days. But to your point, Tony, I'll often go on, like, Facebook, and I'll like, share, like, an old flyer from the channel or an old list of shows, and I'll be like, this is why the channel is so amazing and important. You can literally see Run DMC one night and see the Bad Brains the next night and see One World or, you know, Third World, I'm sorry, you know, or Yellow Man, Roy Orbison after that, and then Slayer, and then, you know, Pantera and Slapshot, and then, you know, anything under the sun. And you also have like Blue Oyster Cult and then the Outlaws, like these national bands were kind of on the way back down. They were still big names. And then all the local bands gave them a chance to, like, really, I mean, that was the greatest stage and the greatest sound system in town by far, right? So everybody wanted to play the channel. So, but even, like, the local bands were all main bands back then, to me, you know, seeing Face to Face or Extreme on the way up. And, you know, again, mentioned the Stompers, John Butcher, Axis, The Fools, like, these bands were, like staples at the club. And they were all local bands. And, they, you know, for a local band to sell, you know, 1,500 tickets, that was a deal. Yeah. You know, that was a big deal back. And back then, you could play the Rat the next week and play Edible Rex and play the club, and you could play all around, and it wasn't going to really hurt any other show. You know what I mean? It was weird. Like now,
I think part of that is what Dinky and I had talked about in the first week on that. There was also a scene at the channel where the club itself was
oh, no doubt.
You know, the club was a draw. There was a crowd hanging there, no matter who was playing. So
I'd also say a lot of times we would like start, like I'd go see a show at, like, say, the Rat or Bun Rowdies, even sometimes three shows a night, but we'd always end up at the channel because the channel was
open till
you know, 2 o'clock license most nights. And we usually, the headline didn't go on stage till 12:30, sometimes 1 o'clock, right? So we knew we'd all end up there eventually, right? So we could, you know, you'd go see your friends play like the first slot at Bun Rowdy's, and go see your other friends play. They're playing at 10 o'clock at the Rat, and then you go down the channel and catch the headlining band or maybe the last two bands and just hang out. And that was the scene, right? And then we would go out and get breakfast at Bally's in Somerville at 4 a.m. after we closed the club down. You know, just, it was a real scene and a kind of a place to get together and center, like you said, you know, and it was a real melting pot to that end. Like, you'd have the goth kids, the metal kids, the thrash kids, the hardcore kids, the punk kids, the skinheads. It was like this real different, diverse audience that would come in. And sometimes it didn't mix really well. Sometimes it was perfect. You know, it just kind of depended on the show and how the bands were. And, you know, again, a lot of it came down to the staffing as well. Like, the more I get into the staffing, I mean, the security of these kind of shows. And
that's the thing I was talking about.
Yeah,
I'm gonna get Tim cut in on here a little bit and ask you some questions because he's kind of our third party moderator, and he's fascinated by this stuff. Tim, Tim Miller's been the entertainment editor at the Cape Cod Times for over 30 years, and a big Boston film critic.
This is a different Tim Miller than the sound guy Tim Miller.
That's not sound guy.
Okay,
totally different.
So Tim's sitting in from a journalist point of view.
Yeah. Well,
so I'm
gonna throw some stuff at you.
How are you doing? So I wanted to ask you sort of more, sort of stepping back on a personal level. Here you were 18 years old, you get a job in security. I mean, how did you all of a sudden find yourself booking shows? Where it would, like, did you, would you go backstage? And how did you get to know these bands?
So the beautiful thing was I was exposed to all these bands, right, by working there. Like I said, we'd often have 4, 5, 6 bands a night sometimes.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. So, you know, I tell people I've seen thousands of bands. I'm not lying.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw thousands of bands. I mean, some very forgettable and some I'll never forget,
right?
So it just, and I got to see all the local bands, because I said we were like, the channel was great because they would give you like a new music Monday. So on Monday nights, we'd have brand new baby bands coming in. You know, Brian Washburn would book these shows. It'd be like 5 or 6 bands, and they'd say, you know, give out free dollar off tickets and bring your friends kind of thing, right? And then Tuesday became Metal Tuesday or Ska Tuesday, like Tony said. We used to have different theme nights, but the idea was you see a lot of local bands kind of on the way up. And you can sometimes tell, like, what band really had some potential, or what band really had their stuff together, what band had been practicing or really rehearsing, what band just kind of goofing around because it's a night out to play the channel. You know, you could kind of tell pretty quickly. And again, I kind of just, you know, gravitated towards that whole kind of metal, hardcore, punk, you know, scene,
yeah.
For lack of a better word. It was just kind of what I really kind of, it kind of hit me more, I guess, with the age I was and what I wanted to be in this whole thing of, like, you know, school authority and, you know, all shows should be 18 ages and, you know, we don't get a fair shake playing these 21-plus clubs and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, as I'm working this club, it's like I'm also seeing these bands. It's almost like a free feeding ground to see new upcoming talent. And then I kind of got more into the business then, just because this is not about the channel. It's like, but you see bands get screwed all the time. Like, you hear about it to this day. It's like bands getting screwed, whether it's from the record label,
yeah.
whether it's from their promotional company or the management company or the clubs or the record. It just depends. You know, bands never get a fair shake, it seems like, right? So I just kind of took that mentality, like, well, I'm going to try and do right by the bands as best I can. And I was in a weird position because I was here, I was working for the channel, representing the venue, but I also had friends in these bands. And I would know, like I said, listen, I know the band's going to draw X number of people. And I'd have these discussions, like with Peter and Harry and John and Jack, I'm sorry, Jack. And we'd say, you know, well, yeah, they're not going to sell any beer, though. I'm like, well, you know, then that's okay. You're going to introduce fans to a new venue, first of all. So all these all-ages kids that can't get to the venue most days, have them come on a Sunday. You know, this is kind of to Tony's point. It kind of created its own little scene, a little bubble where they might have never found the place had it not been for this all-ages Stand Black Church or Slapshot show, right? So
right.
I mean, they take the train to town, get off at South Station, they walk over to the show, and they'd be on a Sunday afternoon, and it's over at 5 o'clock, and then they go home, and it's like, okay, when's the next one, right? But then we'd have a reggae show that night or whatever. It could be any show that night, blues night or local band.
Sean, it meant me and Dinky had to get up at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning after a Saturday night to get in there. We never looked that appreciative when we were sitting in the back office listening.
No. You don't think about those things, right? But it was just, you know, it was fun. And to that point, Tim, it's like, you know, I just kind of, we all became kind of friends. It's like a family, right? When you work on a club like the channel,
yeah.
Which was massive. I mean, you know, it's, you know, I think the legal capacity was either 1,500 or 1,700, but we definitely did more than that a few times on, you know, packed the place in. But you become a family. When you work until 3, 4 in the morning, yeah. you relax to a drink after, and like Tony said, sometimes it's like an 8 o'clock load the next morning, and it's like, okay, shit, who's going to get here in time to open the doors for the bands to load in, and what staff can I depend on to come here and help do the haul of the gear in? It's just, you know, you become a family whether you want to or not. It's just kind of like any family, right? It's dysfunctional, but it works.
Yeah.
Or we make it work, you know?
You took all
some lifelong friends came from it. I mean, Dinky and Tony, we're still friends. I mean, this is 30 years ago at least, I think, 25-plus years ago. So they've been in longer than I've been in it. But to your question, get back to it. Yeah, so I kind of got more into the business end. I was seeing these bands. I was thinking, I had the mindset the bands really weren't treated fairly, especially the underage bands, because they think, well, the clubs think they don't sell any drinks, so no one's going to pay them any money. So I just kind of got more into that, and I started booking shows on the outside of smaller venues to kind of test things out with, the, like I said, the Rat, Green Street Station, Bunratties, And some of the bands started coming to us because the bands in other markets, like New York especially, D.C., Chicago, they would say, oh, there's this cool scene going on in Boston. I, you know, who's booking those shows? We want to play there. We've seen the picture. We've heard about it. You know, it's like, this is this cool. And again, there was no internet back then. There was no cell phones. Right. This is all like word of mouth stuff. Or you would see flyers posted in things like Maximum Rock and Roll and different fanzines, which is kind of like the internet of the time back then, right? Yeah. That's how we communicated. I mean, you see a flyer in a show in Kenmore Square on the phone banks outside the Rat, you know, all these shows coming up. That's how you kind of find out what was going on and what was cool around town, because there was, they weren't advertising the Phoenix or anything back then. These are all like underground things happening. So, but again, it got to the point where eventually they became legitimate drawing bands that could demand guarantees and demand have a good expected crowd and bar sales, et cetera, et cetera. But that's kind of a long-winded answer to how I get into the business side of it. I just kind of, I still did security for a long, long time. Yeah. But I try to also do shows and work with bands and help bands kind of get in front of people. Like I said, I had started with this band, San Blood Church, as my first band I managed. And, you know, I had the opportunity to get them in front of a bunch of kids to see them play in front of Slapshot at the channel. I'm like, well, I'm going to put them on the bill, right? Yeah. They weren't even on the flyer because they were added so late. I have my old flyer. It's just this big, huge Ace of Spades logo of Slapshot, you know, and with a tagged by Maelstrom in Boston's on the fly, but there's no mention of Sandbar Church on there. Yeah. But I added them, and they played, and it was amazing. You know, I think we had ordered like 24 T-shirts. It was going to be our biggest show. We ordered like 24 T-shirts to sell, and they were gone before they hit the stage. They already had a little buzz going, so it was just kind of like, and the scene really supported itself and fed off itself back then. We were all friends. Like I said, I knew the Boston. I lived with the Slapshot guys. I lived with the Sandbar Church guys. Like, we were all in Maelstrom. Same deal. One of the guys in Nelson now plays in San Black Church. Like, we were kind of this community back then, and we all kind of watched up for each other and wanted the best interest. It's like, if we could say we played in front of 800 kids, that was insane. And it happened, you know? It was just an amazing time to be alive, and it really, for the Boston scene, and it kind of went from there, you know?
So were you friends with them before? Like, what were you friends with them before you started managing and booking them, or was it the other round?
I would see the band, let's say, for example, I see the band play the channel, and I would approach them like, hey, you know, I liked what you guys did. I'm doing some shows on a Monday at Green Street Station when Jamaica Plain, you know, like to have you guys play a show kind of thing. That's kind of how most of it started out.
Yeah.
I didn't really know any friends in the business, so to speak, like musical people. I have no music background at all myself. I can't play anything. So okay. My interest or help is I can help in the business end of things. So, yeah.
Did you do much with the Middle East when it grew out, Sean? Because I helped.
Middle East?
I helped Chuck and Martin when they first started.
When that place opened up... I booked Sam Black Church there. Like any bands I was working with, I would book some shows there. But as far as like doing any bookings, like I did a few shows there, but nothing crazy. And not to get off topic, but you know, thank God that place is still going today, because that's where I do most of my shows these days. Because
it ran with the channel stuff when the channel closed.
Oh yeah,
they'd got it alive, Martin and Chuck and those guys.
Yeah, well, they had a nice
channel went under. That was really the only place that was sort of the same kind of
underground,
model, right? Yeah, but yeah. The same kind of yeah. model. It was new bands, and there was still like
totally.
Local stuff.
Totally, yeah. And to this day, knock on wood, thank God they're still there and they're still doing that, Tony. So they are 7 days a week. They've got 3 or 4 different rooms under one roof, and I can't imagine if that place ever closes. It's been rumored for years it's going to be sold or MIT's going to buy it. That would be a dramatic black hole in the Boston community, because that's really kind of ground zero right now for live music in Boston. I mean, all these massive venues.
Dink used to stop in there once in a while.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a good thing. It's a cool scene. Good owners, good people, very friendly, very band friendly, and they'll do anything. Like you said, to the channel ethos, they will play any. There's a reggae show, a rap show, a hardcore show, metal show, blues show. They have belly dancing still upstairs. I mean, they do everything, right? So they do the trip-hop stuff. They have DJs. So, yeah, that place is still very, very vibrant and very, very important. And they did kind of, like you say, pick up the pace when the channel kind of went, because there was no places like the channel. That was a huge room for a lot of bands to come cut their teeth in Boston and play in front of a big house and a great sound system. You know, in the Paradise.
When you got in there with us, and a lot of that by the time we were there in the mid-80s was because, you know, Lansdowne Street was pretty much what it was.
With the
corporate
company,
which has become, you know, Live Nation, for want of a better.
Oh God, yeah.
But
yeah, that was what I was going to say. Like today's
that whole
today,
path, yeah, that whole path was different, and they were ignoring.
Oh yeah.
So much stuff.
The
channel really was picking up a lot of the leftovers, and that's why we got so diverse. That's why we take anything from James Brown to Sisters of Mercy.
Oh.
You know?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and to that point, like Lansdowne Street was really more, and I don't want to say they weren't good, because they had, like, Axis had some good shows, DV8, Spit Upstairs, and Axis had some really good shows, but the stuff in the main room, which was the old Tea Party, like the Metro slash Avalon slash City slash now it's House of Blues, right? So, but they really didn't, to my opinion, do much for the local music community. It was really... the dance club scene, like they would have the shows over by 10, they could have their disco nights, right? They wanted to sell booze. So, you feel like you're rushed out of there. Whereas the channel is the exact opposite. It's like, hey, we want to stay till 2 in the morning. We're going to have live music all night. We don't do that stuff. You know, we don't kick you out at a certain time because we're going to have a dance club. So, Lanzo was a different vibe. It's just a different feel. They didn't really get it. I remember funnily working on the series, like Chuck White and I. There was a series at Avalon that a Privet Vodka sponsored, and it was a Wednesday night series. It was going to be 21 plus because they're obviously a vodka company. They wanted to sell vodka. So they brought in Chuck to do, like the Lions Brothers brought in Chuck to do this series on Wednesdays, and it was all local bands. It was great. Mostly local bands. So it was like six bands on a Wednesday for like $7. But the problem was it was 21 plus. So I remember we did the Boss Tones on one of the days. I'm like, listen, I remember having this meeting upstairs with Patrick Lyons. I'm like, listen, this has to be 18 plus or we're not doing the show. And this is like a day of the show. And I'm like, there's going to be a lot of kids there, a lot of people. And we had this meeting. I'm like, listen, it's like, if we can't do 18 plus, I'm going to go down the street and move the show to the Rat, because the Rat was open that night and the Boss Tones were certainly played there and packed the place. And they changed it to 18 plus, but they're like, you know, it's a 21 plus show. It's like, it's a Privet Vodka series. We need to sell booze, and that's what they're paying us for. But we did get the show, kept it 18 plus, and it stayed there, which was great. It was like the Boss Tones, like Ant Farm, local band. I think Maelstrom played it. I think we had Funk Face from DC played. Like, it was a really cool series that Chucky put together, and I was helping on that in a couple shows. But they, for the most part, really ignored a lot of the local bands, in our opinion. So it was kind of like, yeah, we don't really need them, you know. So yeah, let's go to the Channel, let's go to the Rat, let's go to Bunratty, let's go to the Middle East, and that's kind of the way it was.
It's great to hear your perspective on it, because we're that bit older, and Dinky had come out of the dance club scene DJing, but for my background I was food and beverage guy. I was in the hospitality industry, so you know, obviously our mission in running those places was to make money, and the money was in the booze and in the bars.
Yep.
But finding that balance in the channel was what always fascinated me. I was never had a problem doing all ages shows and no booze, because it was good for the music, and that's what really drew me in more and more to building my career in production and everything. Was the fact?
No, I think you were unusual.
Just about the nightclub, you know.
Yeah, no, and I think I give you credit for that, because honestly, like you say, most food and beverage guys, it's a bottom line thing. It's like, well, we're not going to sell any beer. We're not doing the show. So it's, but you have the openness, and I was thankful that, you know, Peter and Harry let me get in there and do shows there, because I think they also kind of saw what was happening. Like, there was this real big underappreciated scene of kids that were desperate for music, and they wanted to stay. I went to the channel, you know, because it was like they had heard about it, but they couldn't get in, like, legally. So, and eventually, as these bands started getting older and drawing more people did drink. We opened up the back bar, right, with the cage back there. I mean, we had a couple.
I remember scraping a few kids off the floor on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I remember there a couple of times. I think we did a Slayer show, and it was like there were so many people that were 21 plus. We ended up just kind of saying, we almost had to like lock the kids in the bar out front, because there were so many people drinking. It was so crowded. Right. But yeah, there was an audience for that that wanted to drink and see those kind of shows. And there were plenty of kids who just couldn't drink legally, so they just wanted to come see the show and drink soda and eat popcorn. And that was fine, you know. It just worked out. And I remember getting a hard pitch, like, you know, Jack saying, "Oh, we're not going to make any money. I can't do it. You got to pay more for rent." And I'm like, that's not really cool, you know. It's like, and I wrote that fine line like you did, Tony. Like, you're the food and beverage guy. And I was the club guy, right? But I was also the band guy. So I was like trying to work that line of like, hey, listen, let's work with this band. Yeah. Well, it was obviously, you know, let's work with this.
It was developing, you know, into a new model is what was going on.
But yeah, and you kind of needed each other to success, right? Yeah. It didn't work one way or the other. You couldn't either say, nope, no all ages shows or no hardcore shows. And it's like, all right, then you lose all that business. We'll go find someplace else, you know?
Well, the unfortunate thing, Sean, is when it went and it had been independent, that kind of model then translated to the big corporate guys. They figured out how it's coined now on the tickets and everything else.
So there isn't a
club scene that's got that live club feel to it, because everybody's a paid ticket going to a concert. And again, we're out with Two Pints in the Corner. Don't forget to visit us online, www.bostonsbestliverock.com.